From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. After the Soviet Union fell, those of us in America were feeling pretty confident. It seemed to show that after centuries of experimenting with different forms of government in the Western world, we were finally settling on liberal democracy. But the scholar Yasha Monk says, not so fast. Look at the last few years, not just the election of populists like Donald Trump, but the wave of populism in Western Europe. Monk says we have more and more citizens who are more and more disillusioned with their governments than they've ever been. And he says the predicament is so recent and so scary, nobody has managed to make real sense of it. So in a new book, he's diving in to, as he puts it, make sense of this new political landscape, explain the roots of this new social order, but also explain a way forward to bring liberal democracy back. Join us after the news.
On the next More to Say, Michelle Quist is a conservative columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, and she's on the paper's editorial board, too. She's also Mormon, and she's found herself at odds with some conservatives and members of her faith. Some of her recent columns have dealt with the Me Too movement, the death penalty, and guns. She's made a habit of challenging Utah's moral compass. Download the next More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's how confident political scientists were feeling in those years after the Soviet Union fell. They were saying, it's settled. Liberal democracy has won. It was talked about as the only game in town. The scholar Francis Fukuyama said that civilization had finally come to an end point in our ideological evolution. He actually called Western liberal democracy the final form of human government. But the scholar Yasha Monk says in his new book, what if that isn't true? What if we're not, in fact, settled on liberal democracy? Just look at the last few years, not just the election of a populist like Donald Trump, but the wave of populism in Western Europe. Monk says you have more and more citizens who are more disillusioned with their governments than they've ever been. Where people used to be deeply proud of their democratic institutions, Monk is seeing and tracking a growing hostility to democracy. People willing to consider authoritarian rule and to challenge the free press. He says this predicament is so recent and so scary, nobody has managed to make real sense of it. So in a new book, he dives in to, as he puts it, make sense of our new political landscape and explain the roots of this new social order. But in the book, he also explains a way forward to bring liberal democracy back or save it. Yasha Monk is joining us today. His book is called The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He's a lecturer of government at Harvard University, a senior fellow at New America. It's a nonpartisan think tank, also a columnist for Slate and host of the podcast, The Good Fight. I should mention he's going to be in Utah on Saturday for an event at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you details a little bit later on the program about that. Today in the program, he's joining us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And Yasha Monk, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I want to begin, as you do in the book, or one of the things you write about, is what you were seeing when you were in Germany, as you were coming of age there. This was in the late 1990s. And you write about seeing the future as being wide open. What were you seeing there? I mean, this is, I guess, gets to the idea that liberal democracy, this is the thing.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was coming of age in Germany in the late 1990s and early 2000s, I was born in 1982, but I think, you know, people who would have grown up in the United States around the time would have had some similar basic assumptions, which is that, of course, the stakes of politics are high, but we have some deep disagreements, that it really matters what kind of healthcare policy we choose, what kind of policy we have, for example, towards things like gay marriage. But that in the end, the stakes of politics are somewhat limited, that we can assume some basic things. We know the rough outlines of what our country is going to look like 20 or 30 years from now. I thought back then, knew that our basic political system, liberal democracy, would still be in place. As I started to look around and saw growing anger at our politics, more and more disenchantment with our political institutions, and the rise of these new, quite extremist movements mm-hmm. around Europe, I started to wonder whether that was really the case.
You say in the book that we have, most of us have spent the bulk of our lives in ordinary times, but now that things are changing, and here's how you put it in the book, that the basic contours of politics and society are being renegotiated. Now, we'll dig in as we go, but give us a broad sense of what you mean, renegotiated.
Well, so in ordinary times, we agree on the rules of a game.
Yeah.
We might say, you and I have very different political views about this or that issue, but we both think of each other as legitimate participants in a political system, and we both agree to be governed by each other if, you know, unfortunately, sadly, you win the next election. I'm upset about it, but I say, all right, well, you get to rule for the next 4 years. That's how the system works, and my commitment to the system is higher than my commitment to whatever policy issue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in extraordinary times, you know, adversaries start to turn into enemies, and political divides become so poisonous that the thought of actually tolerating rule by some of the other people in your society becomes intolerable. And what happens then is that the very survival of our political system is in doubt.
Mm.
Because once you think anybody who disagrees with me is a traitor or is an enemy of a people, anybody who disagrees with me really can't be allowed to rule, because otherwise, you know, our country is going to be damaged so deeply that there's no recovering. Well, then you might be willing to actually challenge some of the basic rules that we need to agree on in order to preserve a system over time.
Hmm. I just wanted to point out something you write in the book. You say that people for a time were willing to throw out autocrats even when they could offer them a good standard of living. So it wasn't just making the trains run on time or providing, you know, decent economic standards. People had larger expectations for freedom in a certain time, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, the striking thing that political scientists found about the stability of different kinds of political regimes is that, you know, some poor democracies would collapse, right? So when African countries gained independence after colonial rule, you know, some of them managed to preserve democratic rule and a lot of them didn't. And that didn't surprise political scientists, right? When you have very high levels of illiteracy, relatively low levels of education, it's difficult to preserve a democratic system. So that wasn't surprising. You know, conversely, even in some countries that actually did make economic progress, most citizens still continue to think that, you know, in order to really become wealthy, in order to really be able to live a self-determined life, in order to not have to, you know, shut up about certain topics because the dictator might dislike it, I would still prefer to live in a liberal democracy. Mm-hmm. So you saw economically developing countries like South Korea make a difficult and tumultuous but ultimately successful transition from dictatorship to democracy. The one exception to this, the one real case of stability where countries that were both relatively affluent, about $14,000 GDP per capita or more in today's terms, and who had already changed governments for free and fair elections a couple of times. There was no examples on the historical record of countries like that ceasing to be democracies. And so it was very tempting, not just for Francis Fukuyama, who you mentioned earlier in the introduction, but for other political science scholars as well, to assume that countries in the heartland of liberal democracy, the United States, Canada, Sweden, the United Kingdom, were safe. We didn't have to worry about the persistence of a political system there.
But over the course of the last few years, this sense of stability, this idea that we're the only game in town, it's changed. And the book is about what changed. But basically explaining, as I said, we'll dig into this, but what changed? If you can summarize it in a simple way, we'll dig into the complexity here in a moment.
Yeah, so I think, you know, one question about what changed is sort of how do we know that it's changed? And another question is why has it changed? So let's start with how do we know that it's changed?
Yeah.
Well, so one of the things that political science scholars always said is, well, we can be sure about the stability of democracy in places like the United States because it seems to be the only game in town, as you mentioned. And what they meant by that is that most citizens are deeply committed to the democratic system. Very few people are open to authoritarian alternatives to democracy. And all of the participants in the democratic system that really have any real amount of power, anybody who's a governor or a senator or a congressman or, for that matter, a president mm-hmm. has a deep commitment to the most basic rules and norms of his political system. And I started to look and test some of those things. And what I found was pretty striking. So in a study with a colleague, Roberto Faure, we show that actually young Americans give far less importance to living in a democracy than older Americans.
Yeah. Explain that. You're going into the particulars. I think that's good. 2/3 of older Americans said it was extremely important. But what did the younger Americans say?
Yeah, so whereas 2/3 of people in the 1930s, 1940s say, I absolutely need to live in a democracy, less than 1/3 of people born since 1980 did. And some of the figures of support for straightforwardly authoritarian alternatives to democracy are equally shocking. So 20 years ago, about 1 in 16 Americans said that they like the idea of army rule, quite clearly not a democratic system. Now it's 1 in 6, more than twice as many. But if that was just restricted to what people answer to, some kind of opinion survey, you might say, well, it's difficult to interpret those. We don't really know what they mean. But there's another phenomenon, which is that, far-right populist parties, and in some countries, far-left populist parties, that don't accept the basic rules of a political system, that say this system is so corrupt and so rotten that we really need to change it. And you know what? People who disagree with me, they are so illegitimate, they are such enemies of our people that, we shouldn't respect them, are gaining in the vote. In a study I recently did to show that about 8% of voters gave their vote to parties like that in Europe in the year 2000 on average. Now it's gone up to 25%.
Wow.
When you look at the Italian elections about 2 weeks ago, nearly 2/3 of parties have some form of this anti-system attitude, some on the far right of a political spectrum, some that are more ideologically amorphous. But what they have in common is this deep rejection of not just this or that government, this or that politician, but of big aspects of the Italian political system.
One of the things you asked was, you asked people whether that they think having a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with Congress or elections would be a good system of government. So you're not asking them to completely get rid of democracy outright, just kind of some of the other branches, or at least what we come to know of it. So what was the response?
So on that metric too, there's a much greater number of people now who desire that than in the past. In fact, I just got some new data regarding that in Europe, and that shows that this is not just a uniquely American phenomenon. It's happening in all these other countries as well. So in Germany, which certainly has some poor experiences with a strong leader who didn't have to bother with parliament and elections, about 16% of people were in favor of that 20 years ago. Now it's 33%. Mm. In France and the United Kingdom, it used to be 25%. It's now actually 50% who want that kind of political leader. And here's why that's important. I think sometimes when we think about dangers to our political system, it's natural to go back to the most extreme, the most shocking, the most salient instances of that. So think, Adolf Hitler taking power in Germany in 1933. So what does a threat to democracy look like? In our imagination, it is people marching down the street with Hitler salutes and big shiny black boots and torches on fire, right? Well, that's not actually how most democracies go away. Most democracies go away by somebody who says, I am your voice. I truly represent the people. Anybody else is illegitimate. So just trust me. Just trust me to fix things. Trust me, give me a little bit more power and you're going to see the results are going to be great. And then over time, as they concentrate more and more power in their own hands, they slowly abolish the ability of the population to vote them out of office. And so that's why the high support for, a strong leader who doesn't have to bother so much with, Congress, which is unpopular, and elections, which are cumbersome, that is exactly the kind of attitude that can get you into danger.
How is that different from conventional conservative ideology? I mean, they want an honest leader in high office. They want this person to abolish some institutional roadblocks. Isn't that in some ways conventional conservatism?
No, I would say that there's two big differences here. The first big difference is about accepting your political adversary as legitimate. I think there was a very telling moment in the run-up to the 2008 election when John McCain was doing a town hall event in the last days of a campaign, and a woman in the audience stood up and said, you know, Barack Obama is an Arab and he's a bad man, and I'm scared of what will happen if he runs our country. And John McCain said, look, I have deep ideological and policy differences with Barack Obama. I think it's really important that I win the presidency and not him. But you know what? You don't have to be afraid of Barack Obama. He's a decent man. And if he gets to be president, our country is going to be fine. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a conservative attitude. Yeah. Or think about the attitude to particular institutions, like, let's say, the FBI and the Department of Justice. Traditional conservatives valued and celebrated those institutions, more so than liberals sometimes. Well, populists want to take them over and make them something that they can control directly. And you don't just, that's not just about the United States. You see that in Hungary and in Turkey and in Poland and all of these other countries as well. That's not traditionally conservative.
Yeah. There's always been this assumption, you write, that liberalism and democracy, they are inextricably linked. They go together. But this is one of the things you're challenging, is that there's this disconnection between liberalism and democracy. So let's start by saying, having you explain, what do you mean by liberalism? We're talking liberalism with a small L here, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, unfortunately, the term is confusing because it has two very different meanings.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a long philosophical tradition of that term. And what it means is just the basic aspect of constitutional government, right? So it's not about liberal versus conservative. It's not about, you know, Barack Obama versus George W. Bush. It is about a protection of the rule of law, of a separation of powers, of individual minority rights. Those are the basic elements of a liberal political system. And the reason why it's those four things is that cumulatively they allow us individual self-determination. Hmm. They ensure that a majority can't say, we don't like your religion or we don't like your interpretation of a particular religion, so we're going to shut you down. It's to ensure that people can't say, hey, you can't criticize the government. It's to ensure that people can lead their lives freely in that sense. So that's one element of our political system.
Yeah.
And the second element, obviously, is the democratic element,
right,
which is to say that we also want to be able to rule ourselves collectively so that we actually, democracy means the rule of the demos, the rule of the people in the original Greek. And so I think it requires that we actually translate popular views into public policy. Otherwise, we don't seem to be living in a terribly democratic system.
So what does an illiberal democracy look like?
So my fear is that these two things do go together in a sense. I think you need each of the elements of our political system in order to reinforce and stabilize the other. But what we're seeing, I think, is these two things starting to really come apart, drift apart, fall apart. And so what you can get is, on the one side, a system of illiberal democracy or democracy without rights. And what that looks like is, you know, what the Founding Fathers would have called the tyranny of a majority.
Yeah.
Which is to say that you have, as in Switzerland, the majority of a population voting to outlaw the building of minarets, restricting religious freedom of Muslims in that country. You have things like you're seeing in Hungary, in which the prime minister of a period of about 8 years has managed to completely dominate the state media so that it becomes a pure prayer of propaganda, to force the sale of private media companies into the hands of his political allies and, in some case, you know, friends and relations. Mm. You see him starting to control the judiciary, really reforming the judicial system in such a way that the government has a lot of control over it. And you see him even staffing the Hungarian Electoral Commission with all of his cronies. So that in the last months, this commission started to investigate all of the opposition parties and find them miraculously about the amount of money in campaign finance that they had gotten, and you know, decline to investigate in a similar manner the party of the ruling party, Fidesz. And so as a result, the elections that are now rapidly coming up in Hungary are not going to be free and fair anymore. For the AR elections, the opposition does not have a fair shot at actually beating Viktor Orban. So somebody who was elected democratically, that's a democratic element.
Yeah.
Orban was elected by the people. He's actually quite popular. Can no longer be democratically removed because he has so much control over the system. He's abolished the rule of law and the separation of powers to a very, very large degree.
Does Putin fit in this model very well?
I think he does in some important ways. I mean, obviously, democracy in Russia was never very functional.
Yeah.
And so we should sort of make clear that the situation before Putin was probably better in terms of its democratic institutions. It was certainly a more free country, but it was never a very functional democracy. But yeah, there is a remarkable range of these strongmen who use basically the same set of vocabulary, very similar lines, very similar way of framing this opposition between legitimate politicians and the illegitimate opposition. And I would count Putin among that. I would count Recep Erdogan in Turkey among that. I would count the prime ministers in Poland and in Hungary among that. And, you know, personally, I would also count our president in that line.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about, there's one element that I find interesting that seems to be emerging, and that is this anger over journalists. You know, it's reflected in the term fake news here in this country. But let's talk about what you've seen in your own home country of Germany. People you've written about taking to the streets in Leipzig and Dresden to protest, you know, the refugees coming into the country. And one of the things you say is that you hear this hatred of what they call the lying press. And that's central to this idea, this central to the ideology.
Yes, and you know the term the lying press, Lügenpresse in German, it has a very long history. It is a term that was used again and again by the Nazis, and that had really been sort of banned in an informal way from political discourse for many decades. People realized how strongly it reminded people of that time period. And now it's back and being deployed very aggressively by the far-right populist movement there called Alternative for Germany. I found when I went to the street protests in Dresden such a hostility to media that most local TV producers refused to cover the event. And I found one cameraman filming from afar, and I walked up to him, and at first he looked at me a little sort of scared. He clearly has to deal with aggressive people on a regular basis, I explained that I was reporting and so on, and he said, yeah, you know, I agree to film this event because somebody's got to. I don't have kids, I don't have a family, my colleagues with kids refuse to do that. I tried to take a couple of pictures just of banners at the event. I wasn't trying to photograph people, just banners. But when I tried to do that, people really sort of pushed me aside and elbowed me and so on. So there is a deep reservoir of hatred for the press and a deep conviction that you're continually being lied to, which is both quite dangerous and I think a symptom of a previous failure of our political system. I mean, people are given to conspiracy theories when they feel like the system isn't catering to their needs, it's not responding. They don't have really a stake in it. And that, I think, is why people have become so willing to, act on crazy conspiracy theories or be convinced that every journalist is at heart, out to plot against the people.
You know, one of the things that you've written about this, there was this study in The Atlantic. You wrote about this, the results of this study in 2014, Gillens and Page, these political scientists. And one of the things they found is that, and you could talk about the particulars here, but they found that ordinary citizens have, as they put it, no independent effect at all on policy. And in that sense, I suppose it makes sense that people feel left out, that they're not, in fact, playing a role, that they're being ignored. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, so I think if, you know, we think of the populists as illiberal Democrats, as people who are trying to push a sort of form of democracy without rights, I think that is partially a counter-reaction to the system we've had for a long time, which at least has elements of what I would call rights about democracy or undemocratic liberalism, which is a slightly ugly term. So what I mean by that is that we've had a political system for a long time in which there was a tremendous role of money in politics, in which there's a revolving door between lobbyists and legislators, in which many politicians have slightly become a sort of class apart, who are more comfortable with other politicians or with lobbyists than with their own constituents. And as a result, people for a long time have felt that my voice isn't heeded anyway. It doesn't really matter who I vote for. It doesn't really matter what I do. In the end, the special interests and, you know, so on are going to win out, and my interests are going to be ignored. And so it is that sense of frustration that drives a lot of his anger. Now, you know, populists are brilliant at exploiting that. And generally speaking, you know, if a stopped clock is right twice a day, I think populists tend to be right, you know, four or five times a day. And they tend to be right in their analysis. They tend to be a good channel of some of the actual frustrations that people have, often for perfectly understandable reason. The problem is that the solutions they offer tend to be false, tend not to be very convincing.
Well, I was listening to the historian and conservative Neil Ferguson recently, who talked about he feels like populism is going to have a short cycle. He doesn't sound at all as worried as you might be, because leaders, for that very reason you mentioned, that populist leaders don't or can't deliver on their promises. And so you have citizens who just become disillusioned, and populist leaders tend to just fall by the wayside. And I just wanted to get a sense of what you make of that response.
You know, I'm very friendly with Neil, and he's an important historian, a great thinker. We were on a show together a few months ago, and he made a similar point, to which, to his chagrin, I was forced to call him unhistorical, which is to say that he has this assumption that populists, you know, make all of these big promises, they get into office, they fail to deliver on the promises, and so then people take the rational conclusion of saying, well, that was a mistake, things aren't actually getting better, so let's get rid of them.
Yeah.
Well, when you actually look at what happened in various countries when populists rose, that just doesn't pan out. That is not how it plays out. So take the Italian elections. You know, for two decades, a man by the name of Silvio Berlusconi dominated Italian politics. He has no similarity to anybody in America could think of, a real estate billionaire with lots of sex scandals and a very testy relationship to the media and the judiciary and the you know, apparatus of law enforcement. I'm not sure who else might be like that. In 2011, people were really sick of him. They really felt that he hadn't served the country well. He was extremely unpopular. And when it became obvious that he would tend his resignation to the country's president, this beautiful, you know, thousands of people came to the streets, this beautiful amateur orchestra and choir turned up to play Handel's Hallelujah. There was a real sense of Italy having turned a page. Well, 7 years on, Silvio Berlusconi is back as the kingmaker in Italian politics once again. Mm-hmm. And two other populist parties, which are actually more extreme in their hostility to existing institutions, and some of them, like the League, much more extreme ideologically as well, are now, between them, having two-thirds of the vote in the country. And there's lots of other examples of that as well. Fujimori in Peru, who was actually sentenced to a long prison term, has recently been pardoned and is now dominant in the country's politics again. So no, unfortunately, once populism enters the political system, I think it tends to stick. And there's one obvious reason for that, which is that a political system lives to some degree of taboos. It lives of the assumption that there's some things you just can't do. You can't go around attacking the most basic institutions that have high approval ratings in the whole population, that everybody thinks does a perfectly decent job, like, say, people did about the FBI a couple of years ago. People assumed there would be political suicide. Well, once you prove that that's not political suicide, that by ratcheting up tension and ratcheting up mutual hatred across the political divide, you actually can carry such a big part of the base that you're politically viable, well, that makes it very tempting for other people to do the same thing. sometimes from the same ideological direction, sometimes from a different ideological direction, but that hostility to our basic institutions is very contagious.
Yasha Monk is with us. He's a lecturer on government at Harvard University, a senior fellow at New America. That's a nonpartisan think tank. His new book is The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. On Saturday, he's going to be in Salt Lake City reading from and signing his new book. He'll be at the King's English Bookshop. You can find details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. There's also a link to his podcast called The Good Fight. You can find it there on the website as well. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of democracy. And think about it. As a form of government, liberal democracy seems to have won over communism and monarchies and fascism. But what if that wasn't true? What if liberal democracy for Americans is no longer the only game in town? The scholar Yasha Monk says things are changing. More and more people are becoming more and more disillusioned with this system. He has a book that works through all of this called The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Yasha Monk is joining us today. He'll be in Utah this weekend. We'll give you some details about the visit a little bit later on the program. So I wanted to go through some of these reasons for the fact that liberal democracy is being challenged, because you go through some of these in the book. One of these is declining living standards. What are the conditions of democracy that are changing? And start with living standards, if you would, because it's gone flat, and that's a factor here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so look, as a social scientist, when you see that a phenomenon persisted for a long time and then suddenly there seems to be a big change, you want to ask, well, what is it that produced the stability in the past and what is it that's producing the change now? Where's the discontinuity? And so in the book, I go beyond, you know, what happened in the last couple of years. I go beyond what happened in the United States and look at what are the long-term drivers of change in countries across the West, because you see the rise of populism across the West. And the most striking of them, not the only one, but the most obvious in some ways, is the stagnation of living standards for ordinary people. Look, in the United States, from 1945 to 1960, the living standard of an average family doubled. From 1960 to 1985, it doubled again. And since 1985, it's essentially, as you're saying, been flat. That really changes how people think and talk about politics. It's not that they ever used to think of Washington, D.C. as the paragon of moral virtue in the country, or that they completely loved and trusted politicians. But they said, you know what? I'm twice as rich as my parents were. My kids are probably going to be twice as rich as me. Something seems to be working. You know, let's give those politicians the benefit of a doubt.
Right.
Now they're saying, hey, you know what? I've worked hard all my life. I'm not really doing any better than my parents did. Looks like my kids might do a lot worse than me. I might be a lot worse off once I'm in retirement. So, you know what? Let's change some things up.
Hmm.
Let's give the system a good shake. How bad could things get?
Yeah. So now, they've come to see it as a zero-sum game, basically, politics.
They've come to see politics as a zero-sum game, and they've come to distrust that the people who are running the show actually care about them.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, right? I mean, if there's some game and you keep getting prizes, you might not understand exactly how the game works or how the game is played, but you go home pretty happy. If you're playing a game and you keep getting zilch out of it, you say, hey, something's rotten here.
Yeah. The second thing you point out is that in the past, and this has been particularly true in Western Europe, is that one ethnic group has been dominant. But that's changing now, of course.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you look at the continent where I grew up, at Europe, you know, democracy in many countries there took hold after World War II, in part because of the tragedy of World War II and the ethnic cleansing that was involved. You ended up with these very homogeneous countries. And so, you know, to an average Italian, Swede, Frenchman, German in 1950, 1960, it was obvious who belongs and who doesn't belong. Mm. The people who belonged, they said, were people who were descended ethnically from the same group. Now, the reality was always a bit more complicated than that, but that's how people thought about it.
Yeah.
And it certainly entailed that somebody who's brown or black, somebody who is Muslim or Jewish or Hindu, was not, you know, a true Italian, a true Swede, and so on, and how people thought about it. Well, over the past 50 or so years, we've had a lot of immigration on the European continent, and you've started to have a change in that conception, some legal changes, certainly some changes in how a lot of people think about this. They can now recognize that the descendants, say, of Turkish workers in Germany have become real Germans. But there's also tremendous resentment against it in sections of a population. And that, for we don't need to condone that, I don't condone that, it shouldn't surprise us, right? If you're not the richest guy in the world, if you're not the best educated guy in the world, if you perhaps don't feel like you get a tremendous amount of social respect, it's really easy to look at an immigrant who's treated as a second-class citizen and say, well, at least I'm better than that guy over there, yeah. right? Yeah. At least I have a higher social status than him, and that's right, right? Well, that's being challenged. That's being taken away. Now, the situation in the United States has always been similar and different. It's been different in that, obviously, this has always been a country of immigrants, and it has always been a multi-ethnic society. But it's similar
yeah.
in that there's always been a strict racial hierarchy in the United States, with you know some religious and ethnic groups having tremendous advantages over others. Now, the good news here is that despite ongoing injustices, despite some ongoing discrimination, we've come an awfully long way in overcoming that. I think there's no doubt about the fact that it's better being a religious or ethnic or sexual minority in this country today than it would have been 20 or 40 or 60 years ago. But again, some people have something to lose from that. They have some of their privileges and some of their status taken away from them. And there's a real rebellion against that and a real, you know, concern about how the country is changing.
The other stabilizing force that you say is falling by the wayside is that mass communication is no longer just the domain of the elites. This seems to be an important one, too.
Yeah. So, you know, when you go back 25 years, we essentially lived in a system of communication that wasn't so different from what we would have had after the invention of a book press 300 years ago, 400 years ago. That seems like a puzzling claim, because in 1992, CNN would, you know, transmit sound and picture of news events from all around the world and beam it into your living room. That's very different from what you could do, say, in 1700.
Yeah.
But there's one essential similarity, which is that it was a form of one-to-many communication.
Right.
There was people in a geographical center who owned radio, television stations, newspapers, publishing houses, and they decided who was given a platform on those media. Now, that could be a bad thing. It could limit the range of voices that actually had a real stake in our national conversation. But it also had a positive aspect, which is that they said, well, if you're just spreading lies, if you're saying things that are completely inaccurate, if you are straight up racist, then we don't really want you on our platforms. And so it marginalized those voices as well. Well, over the past 25 years, you first had the rise of the internet, which made it possible for anybody to broadcast yeah. to a big mass of people. But it was still difficult to find that, right? If I made a website, joeblogs.com, you know, most people wouldn't go to it. They wouldn't find it. Well, social media has changed that as well.
Yeah.
Now, mm-hmm. even if you have, you know, 100 followers on Twitter or on Facebook, and you're on a United Airlines flight and you're reaccommodated, somebody tweets a video of that to your 100 followers, well, if 10% of them and 10% of their followers and 10% of their followers retweet that, millions of people can see it within a matter of an hour or two. So this is an opportunity. It makes it possible for important people to enter our national conversation who may have been ignored a few years ago. But it is also a danger, because it makes it much easier for people who want to spread hate, who want to spread fake news, who want to organize radical political movements, to find each other, to connect with each other, and to spread those ideas.
Here's how you put it in the book. The instigators of instability have won an advantage over the forces of order.
That's exactly right. So it's not necessarily, you know, it's a funny thing, but 3 or 4 years ago, people were saying, oh, the internet is going to democratize the world and it's absolutely a good force. Now I think a lot of people have switched and said, oh, the internet is this terrible danger and it's by its nature inimical to democracy. I don't think that's right. I think what it does is to favor people who want to smash the system up and change things, and disadvantage people who want some amount of stability.
Yascha Mounk is with us. His book is The People Versus Democracy, Where Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He'll be here on Saturday. He'll be at the King's English Bookshop. You can find details about that on our website, radiowest.org. You can also find a link to his podcast called The Good Fight there as well. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to Yascha Mounk. We're talking about his new book, The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He's coming to Utah. He'll be here this weekend. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. All right. I wanted to get to, because a big part of the book, an important part of the book, are these antidotes to this emerging populism trend. And I wanted to go through some of those. Let's start with the first one that you mentioned, and that is you say we need to reform economic policy. Explain what you're thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if people used to trust the political system because they got something out of it, they felt like they're doing much better than their parents, then one easy way of trying to quell this groundswell of anger that we see across the Western world is to make sure that they get something out of the system and that they have confidence that the future will be better than the present. Now, look, you know, I'm on book tour at the moment. Depending on where I speak, I get questions that are sometimes more from a conservative end, sometimes more from a left-wing end. I sometimes get people saying, well, shouldn't we just abolish capitalism? Isn't that the only way of solving this? I don't agree with that. Yeah. Because there haven't been successful democracies in countries that aren't capitalist. And by the way, if you care about people around the world, it's very difficult not to look at the tremendous progress that we've made through globalization. 2 billion people in India and China who have been lifted out of dire poverty, people who didn't have access to electricity, who didn't have access to education, who didn't know if they would have anything to eat that night, and who are now living a middle-class life. And this is just over the past couple of decades. So I disagree with that. I think we need to work with globalization, we need to work with capitalism, but there are ways to ensure that ordinary people get something out of that. Look, it's not in the nature of capitalism that we don't do nearly enough to stop some rich people from hiding the money in tax havens. It's not in the nature of capitalism that we allow corporations to pay far less tax if a nominal headquarters is in Delaware rather than in Utah, or in Luxembourg rather than the United States. It's not in the nature of capitalism that we have local laws and restrictions which makes it really hard to build new housing units, so that even people who have a decent income in the metropolitan centers in the United States now pay such a vast share of it on housing that the effective quality of life is lower than that of their parents. And it's nothing to do with capitalism, but we're underinvesting in the education of our children and not providing enough opportunity for adults to continue to develop their skills, push their skills, so that we have real rises in productivity around this country. All of those are political choices, and we can fix them.
But what do you mean when you say that countries need to take control of their own fate? That we should be part of a globalization process for sure, but you're not talking about protectionism there, are you?
No, absolutely not. Look, the slogan of the people, of the Brexiteers, of the people who were arguing for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union was take back control.
Yeah.
Now, to some degree, there was a dog whistle about immigration, but I think there is a core to it which I absolutely sympathize with, which I think is right, which is that people at the moment feel like, I don't really have any control over my life. I feel like whether I'm still going to have a decent income or not tomorrow is up to forces that I can't control.
Yeah.
And my country doesn't really seem to be in control of its fate in the age of globalization, because people keep telling me there's nothing we can do in order to control all of these complicated forces. And so why vote for politics if my politicians can't actually stand up for me anyway? No, I think that's wrong. I think there's ways that we can take control. The state can help individuals make sure that they have the skills and the education they need in order to succeed, that if they do become temporarily unemployed, we help them find productive jobs quickly. And I think there's things that the state can do to ensure that the fruits of globalization are spread more fairly, like the things I was talking about with ensuring that people actually pay the taxes they owe.
And another one of the things that you mentioned as a kind of an antidote is to rethink what it means to belong to a modern nation state. And the idea here is, as I understand it, is you're trying to get us to emphasize the things that unite us rather than divide us. And so I'm wondering what that means then, you think, for what you're seeing in terms of identity politics and group rights. Does that trouble you a bit?
Well, I like to avoid the term identity politics because everybody means something else by it, and right. So I think it sort of it doesn't lend itself to a productive discussion. But here's what I would say about it, which is that nationalism can be a tremendous force for good, and it can be a tremendous force for bad. As I mentioned, I grew up in Europe. I'm Jewish and grew up in Germany, so I certainly have an instinctive understanding of what it means when nationalism goes wrong. And so my temptation for a long time was to just disavow nationalism altogether, to say perhaps we should leave that behind in the 20th century, which it so cruelly shaped, and give up on collective identity. Another response to it, which I do see very prominently now on parts of the left, and which might be called identity politics by some, is to say let's celebrate every collective group at the subnational level. So let's celebrate every religious group, let's celebrate every ethnic group, let's celebrate every sexual minority, but let's never celebrate our collective identity of a nation that connects us beyond that. Now, I think that both of those reactions are a mistake. And they're a mistake because nationalism, in my mind, is a half-domesticated animal. If you leave it to itself, then the worst kinds of people, the most hateful kinds of people, are going to come in and stoke it and provoke it until it runs amok, until it says anybody who's not part of a dominant group, anybody who's not white, anybody who's not descended from the Italian people, they don't belong here, right? And so I think what we need to do is to fight for a more inclusive notion of what this nationalism does. And why do we need to do it? A, because it's a tremendous form and source of solidarity. It's what allows you and me to be upset when there's a huge storm in Houston or a huge storm, for that matter, in Puerto Rico and say, those are our fellow citizens. We owe them our help. And it's also important because we want to preserve the liberal element in liberal democracy, which is to say people's rights to actually be individuals and make their own choices. And we have to enforce that right not just against the state, but also against their own group if it becomes oppressive and tries to tell its members what to do. So, a nice encapsulation of that for me comes in a campaign speech that Emmanuel Macron, the now French president, gave in the city of Marseille. And I have my disagreements with Macron, but I think it expresses that spirit very nicely. He said, look, when I look in the audience here, I see people from the Ivory Coast and from Mali and from Algeria and from Italy and from Poland. But what do I see? I see the people of Marseille. What do I see? I see the people of France. Look here, ladies and gentlemen, from the Front National, the far-right populist movement of Marine Le Pen. This is what it means to be proud to be French. That is a form of reclaiming what nationalism means, which I think is productive and inclusive and emphasizes what unites us rather than what divides us.
You go through a number of other factors that you think can help the situation. Getting a grip on the internet and social media is one that you write about, and then also rebuilding trust in politics. And since we're running out of time, we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but I did want you to say something about what you're seeing in terms of civic education. You say in the book that civic education in all its forms used to be kind of at the core of the American project, but today, and this is how you put it, it's all but extinct.
So the founding fathers talk about civic education a lot because they had a sense of the fragility of the institutions, right? They founded the American experiment at a time when every experiment in collective self-government in the history of mankind had failed. What they were doing was kind of crazy. And so they knew that it would take fighting for our political values in order to make it stick and in order to make it succeed. Well, I think we've become complacent. And so what I see on the one side is a lack, for example, of attention to civics. When you look at high school curricula, they teach civics much, much less than they would have done 2 or 3 or 4 decades ago. And I also see a temptation, and I see that, you know, including on the faculty at Harvard where I teach, to just emphasize the shortcomings and the bad things in our political system without emphasizing what's good about it. Now, look, there are lots of injustices in our country. And going back to the last bit of a conversation, we absolutely need to defend some of the minority groups that are under attack from those kinds of attacks. And we have to do that unflinchingly and uncompromisingly. But there's also lots of good things about our political system. For all of its flaws, we do to some extent manage to give people the tremendous freedom of choosing how they lead their lives individually. And we do still have an ability to get rid of politicians when we don't like them. It is much better to live today in the United States than it is to live in Russia or in Venezuela or in China or in a whole set of other countries around the world. And I think we need to insist on that and emphasize that much more proudly than we do.
Yascha Mounk, his book is The People Versus Democracy, Where Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He'll be in Utah in Salt Lake City on Saturday at 7 o'clock. He's going to be at the King's English Bookshop. You can find more details about that on our website, radiowest.org, and there you'll find a link to his podcast called The Good Fight. He joined us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Yascha Mounk, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. This was a real pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.